Holy Week has begun for Christians around the world, and cards on the table, full disclosure, I'm one of them. Can I actually say that on the radio in 2014? I am a Christian. Well, I don't care. I'm telling you now. So as we head into Holy Week, I've been thinking a lot about a nice piece of herringbone twill. And I'm not talking about one of my sports jackets that's hanging in the front hall closet. I'm talking about a piece of linen, roughly 14 feet by 3.5 feet long and wide. And it is arguably the most studied artifact, or to be more accurate, relic, in all of history. A centuries-old linen cloth that bears the image of a crucified man. A man that millions believe to be Jesus of Nazareth. Here's a rather impressive laundry list of what you'll see on the shroud if you're staring at it. If you happen to get to the Turin Cathedral in Italy, which is dedicated to St. John the Baptist. On the shroud, you'll see a series of wounds on this figure. One wrist bears a large round wound, apparently from piercing. The second wrist is hidden by the folding of the hands. There's an upward gouge in the side, penetrating into the thoracic cavity. Proponents say this was a post-mortem event, and there are separate components of red blood cells and serum draining from the lesion. Small punctures around the forehead and scalp. Think of the crown of thorns. Scores of linear wounds on the torso and legs. Proponents suggest the wounds are consistent with the distinctive dumbbell wounds of a Roman flagrum. And large puncture wounds in the feet, as if pierced by a single spike. What does it all mean? Is the shroud, in fact, the burial cloth of Jesus? And if so, then what? If it does, in fact, contain evidence of a resurrection event, as my guest believes, what would that look like? How could you measure it? What in the world is a resurrection event? Coast to Coast is about to get deep into the metaphysical when I'm joined on the line by Dr. Andrew Silverman as we discuss the light of the shroud here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett with you. In 1988, a radiocarbon dating test was performed on small samples of the Shroud of Turin. The laboratories at the University of Oxford, the University of Arizona, and the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology concurred that the samples they tested dated from the Middle Ages, between 1260 and 1390. For many, that radiocarbon dating test's findings meant it was essentially case closed and proof positive that the shroud was in fact a clever and sophisticated medieval forgery. However, those findings have been disputed, and we'll get into the reasons why here in just a few moments. But suffice to say that the status of the Shroud of Turin is murkier than ever, not least of which is what is the nature of the image and how it was fixed on the cloth. It remains deeply puzzling. The shroud continues to remain one of the most studied and controversial objects in human history. Here to talk more about new scientific evidence in support of the authenticity of the Shroud of Turin is Dr. Andrew Silverman, a medical doctor with a background in physiology. He's been interested from an early age in the nature of what we are as human beings and what our potential is. He's always been fascinated to know how the image on the Shroud of Turin could have formed, being mindful of the fact that it cannot be replicated even with 21st century technology. In May 2010, he presented a paper on the Turin Shroud at a conference at the Atomic Physics Research Center in Frascati, Italy, and he presented two more papers at the University of Turin in Poland in May 2011. Dr. Andrew Silverman, welcome to Coast to Coast. How are you?
Well, thank you. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you with us. One of the interesting things about you, Dr. Silverman, and there are many, but the thing that strikes me is that you don't have a skin in this game. In other words, from what I understand, you don't necessarily have an opinion one way or the other about the divinity of Jesus Christ. You're simply looking at the scientific evidence that might suggest there is evidence for a resurrection event in that linen cloth. Is that correct?
Well, I don't look at the shroud from religious perspective. I look at it to try to understand the evidence that is on the cloth and looking at all the empirical studies that have been done. And the amazing thing is that, as you say, we don't know how to replicate an image that has similar properties, even using modern 21st century technology. So if it wasn't produced, if it wasn't manufactured, but it happened in some other way, then for me, then that has to open up lines of investigation to find out how such a thing is possible and consider all the ramifications and implications in a neutral, unbiased way without recourse to any kind of dogma, be it religious dogma or dogma of scientism, as one might say. So to take a look at all of the evidence and to look at it and see how it might fit together into a coherent picture, really.
And you're coming at this from the perspective of a medical doctor with a background in physiology. Now, earlier, I sort of gave the laundry list of some of the images on the shroud, these wounds. If I could just get you to go sort of back over those, and speaking as a medical doctor, again, with a background in human physiology, tell me what stands out in your mind in terms of what's depicted or what is actually on this linen cloth, these wounds that we hear about.
Certainly. Well, I'll say about how the evidence was first observed in detail. Back in 1978, a team of scientists went over to Turin and were given round the clock access to the cloth for 120 hours. That's they were called the Shroud of Turin Research Project, and their brief was to try to understand and explain what had caused the image on the cloth. And they came from a variety of backgrounds, and most of them expected to go there and find the brushstroke, so to speak, and they would be able to just say, oh, this is how it was manufactured. And they all came away from there with the opinion that there's no way that they could account for it having been manufactured. It didn't have any signs of having been the image being produced by an artist. They couldn't account for how it could happen. And when they looked at the red marks on there that appear to be bloodstains, and these were sent for chemical analysis, they were found to in fact be bloodstains, not to be paint. And when they were analyzed further from a forensic point of view, then you can see that the stains on the cloth, the bloodstains on the cloth, show the signs that of a man who had been tortured. He'd been whipped many times. He'd had a cap of sharp objects like thorns placed upon his head, and he had been crucified, not as paintings and medieval art would depict, through the hands, but actually through the wrists. And now we know from pathological research that has been done that had someone been crucified through the hands, that there wouldn't have been enough strength in the flesh to take the weight of the body. It would have torn. It would have had to have been in the wrist. And also, you can actually see from the pattern of the blood that the positions that the man had been on the cross when he had been crucified. Now, this is putting into effect knowledge about anatomy and pathology that is only been found much more recently. And the other thing that is vital to that we can see from the bloodstains is that at the time that the shroud wrapped the body of the man, he was already dead.
How do we know that, Dr. Silverman?
Yes. The way that we know is if you've ever spent much time, as I have, in an emergency room, you'll see that when people come in with significant wounds, especially, for example, on the scalp, they will be covered in blood because of the extent of the wounds and how much blood comes out. Now, due to some great research that was done by a physician in the United States, Dr. Gilbert Lavoie, he did some experiments about how bloodstains become imprinted on cloth. Now, the thing is that you can only get bloodstains from contact with cloth on the body if the bleeding happened within 2 hours at a maximum of the time that the contact between the body and the cloth happens. And, of course, once the bleeding stops, then the countdown starts, so to speak. It dries out, and so it doesn't transfer. So if the man had still been alive when he'd been wrapped in the cloth, then because the blood would still have been pouring out, the cloth would be absolutely saturated in blood, particularly around the head and the face area. But what we see is just the most recently shed blood before the point of death. And so we can see that he was already dead when the cloth wrapped him because of the relatively small amount of blood that's on there. Now, the blood stains have been analyzed in quite some detail by the forensic people. For example, what looks like a backward three on the forehead, that can be shown to be traced to the way that blood would drip down on the furrows of a brow when the muscles had been tense at the time that the blood was coming down, and so on. And there's other fascinating information. Again, something that was picked up by Dr. Lavoie was that the blood stains, some of them appear to be in the superimposed on the region where you can see the hair of the in the image. And that would seem a little bit strange until he realized he did an experiment to wrap a cloth around the face of someone that had had paint put on their face. And then when you stretch out the cloth, make it flat, then you can see that blood that had come from the side of the face, when you flatten the cloth out, would be superimposed on where we now see the image of the hair. Now, that brings us on to, of course, a very important point, is that there's two different types of markings that we can see on the cloth related to the man that seems to have been wrapped in the shroud. One is the bloodstains, which appear to have been formed shortly after the man had died and when the cloth was wrapped around the body. And then the other, which we'll, of course, come back to in more detail, is the image of the man, both front and back. If you look at the shroud when it's displayed, as I have done when I've been to Turin for some of the expositions, you can see that it's, as you say, a 14-foot-long piece of cloth, and on one side of it you can see the image of the front of the man towards your right, so to speak, as I remember, and then on the left side you can see the back of the man, and a slight space between the back image and the front image where there's a water stain in between the two, and it implies that he had been laying flat on the cloth after death, and that the cloth had been folded over the top of the head and over the front of the body.
Correct. So we have a I guess sort of a pectoral and a dorsal image, if I can use those terms. Right.
And
now, go ahead, yes.
And this image doesn't have that same distortion that the bloodstains do in terms of implying that it had been wrapped. The image isn't stretched out when you flatten the cloth. And that's very interesting.
Well, why is that significant? What does that mean?
Well, it implies that we're looking at two different events here. You see, if you analyze the bloodstains and look at it microscopically, what you see is what you would expect to see, that the fibers are matted together by the blood that has contacted the cloth, and the blood sinks through the surface layers of the cloth, as you would expect from a stain. And also, you can see in some areas there are serum rings around the blood stains, which is again what we would expect. And this was only detected when it was seen that there was fluorescence when you apply ultraviolet light. And this is a characteristic feature of serum, which is the liquid that exudes from clotted blood, basically. Now, the image actually is only confined to the uppermost part of the fibrils. It's been shown to be around only 1/5,000th of a millimeter in thickness, so much less than the thickness of a human hair. And it's not composed of anything that has been added to the cloth, but instead it's formed by a chemical change in the surface of the cloth, which is very similar to the chemical change which happens in the cellulose of paper when it's exposed to sunlight, to cause the yellowish sepia discoloration of the paper. And in fact, that's what you see. And the interesting thing is that where there are blood stains, when these were analyzed by the STIRP team, if you look underneath them, there is no image. So it appears as though the blood stains happened first and the image happened later. And the aspect of the body and the cloth at the time that the blood stains formed and the image formed appear to be different. And I'll expand on that a bit later.
Yes, we will. Let me just remind listeners, Dr. Andrew Silverman is with us, a medical doctor with a background in physiology, and we're talking about new scientific evidence that would tend to suggest the Shroud of Turin, this ancient piece of linen cloth, is what it's purported to be, the actual burial cloth of Jesus of Nazareth. Now, we're coming up on a break here, but when we come back, I want to back up a little. You covered a lot of ground there, but I want to go back to sort of the physiology and talk about, for example, the significance, and again, these are things that argue against this being a clever forgery, but the significance of the thumbs not being visible in the image on the shroud and how that relates to the actual crucifixion. Back with more of my conversation with Dr. Andrew Silverman, The Shroud of Turin, here on Coast to Coast AM. My name is Richard Serrett. In any event, I'm wondering whether Tom Waits will be staring up at the night sky tomorrow night when we are expecting quite a show, the first of four blood moons, total lunar eclipses that will appear blood red in the night sky. Of course, those lunar eclipses over the next year and a half, all landing on Jewish high holidays, Passover, Sukkot, and bookending a total solar eclipse, which I believe also occurs on a feast day of the Lord. Some are calling this, of course, a signpost, a heavenly signpost, the beginning of Jacob's troubles or the tribulation. And of course, NASA says, no, it's just four total eclipses of the moon, nothing more and nothing less. All right, we are talking about the Shroud of Turin with Dr. Andrew Silverman, and we'll be back on the other side. He's coming at this from the perspective of a medical doctor with a background in physiology, and I'd like to drill down on that subject as we discuss this remarkable piece of linen cloth on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. And we are back. Welcome back to Coast AM. Dr. Andrew Silverman joining us on the line from the United Kingdom, where it is very early in the morning, and we are discussing this remarkable piece of linen cloth. Some say it's a clever medieval forgery, and some say it is the actual burial cloth of Jesus Christ. Now, Dr. Silverman, I'm particularly interested to get your take on this. If you look at the shroud, the hands are very interesting in that you only see four fingers. You don't see the thumbs. Why is that significant?
Well, you know, if the nail had actually penetrated through the wrist, in the center of the wrist, it would probably have gone through a structure known as the median nerve. And we know that stimulation of the median nerve causes a muscle to contract, which pulls the thumb in behind the hand, you see. So it's all really very consistent pathologically with what we see, with this being a genuine cloth of, that had once wrapped the body of a man who had been crucified. Now, of course, the question is raised, who was this man? And this is a very interesting one to try to answer. Now, first of all, we have to look at the question of the provenance of the cloth and how old is it. Now, as you say, the carbon dating was reported to have shown that the cloth dated from around 1260 to 1390. You know, I was a student at the time when the paper was published in the journal Nature that actually set out the results, and I was fascinated to see a little corner of the paper where they actually had some of the statistics, which actually, when you look at the error bars, so to speak, for the different laboratories, you could do a statistical test of the question of whether each of those three laboratories tested cloth of the same age, and you'd have to answer at the 95% confidence level, as you would say statistically, but it appears they didn't. There was a significant difference between the laboratories. And now the thing is that they threw out all the protocols that had been originally planned, that it was supposed to have been, they were supposed to have dated samples from lots of different parts, seven different parts of the cloth, and tested with two different methods. And instead, it was all taken from just one corner that had been one of the most handled and contaminated throughout time, and throughout since the cloth had been around, at least. And there is some evidence that was a couple in the States spotted that there were some differences between that corner of the cloth and the rest, called Sue Benford and Joe Marino.
In other words, Dr. Silverman, what you're saying here is that the piece or the sample of the cloth that was used to conduct this radiocarbon date testing may have been actually a piece of patch cloth that had been sewn into the shroud. Perhaps it was the result of being overhandled. They had to replace that piece of cloth, or a result of fire damage. Of course, there was a fire at the cathedral in Turin. Is that what you're saying?
Actually, it doesn't appear that it was a patch. But what the Joe Marino had suggested is that there may well have been something called a reweave. There's a technique which is still used sometimes to this day, called the invisible reweave technique, French reweave, and it's there are certain nuns who do this when they're repairing cloth. And you see, what it means is that you need to, if you had introduced, say, for example, in the 16th century, in the strip of cloth that was tested, if it contained around 60% of material that is from the 16th century, and even if the actual original cloth had been at that time 1500 years old, in other words now 2000 years old, then that would be sufficient to account for the dates that were found between 1260 and 1390. Now, one of the STIRP team, Raymond Rogers of Los Alamos laboratories, he was one of the team that went there in 1978, and like all the others, he was convinced that the image couldn't have been manufactured, or that they couldn't see a way that it could have been manufactured. When the carbon dating result came out, though, he said, okay, well, I'm a scientist, I have to accept what the data shows. Maybe it was medieval, even though we don't know how it happened. And so Benford and Marino, when they spotted the difference between that corner and the rest of the cloth, and suggested their reweave possibility, he said that I've got the material to prove these people wrong in 5 minutes, because he still had some fibers from that were taken from near the area where the carbon dating had been done, and also some fibers from elsewhere on the cloth, And he said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to submit them to chemical analysis. I see what he was, a chemist, you see, and show that they're basically the same. And then sometime soon after, he went on the record, and was actually there was a video of him saying this shortly before he died, and he published a paper about it in a peer-reviewed scientific journal called Thermochemical Reactor, that he said, I set out to prove these people wrong, and I ended up proving them right. The cloth that was part of the cloth that was dated was not representative of the cloth. So they, in a sense, the procedures that were done through no fault necessarily of the carbon dating laboratories, who in good faith tested the samples that they were given, but for whatever reason, the samples that they were given were not representative of the cloth, and so the wrong date came up. And it's all the controversy around this has led the professor, who was at the time was a research assistant when the carbon dating happened, but now runs the Oxford Radiocarbon Lab. He's still not convinced of the shroud's authenticity, but he accepts that in view of all the other historical evidence that suggests that the cloth is far older than the carbon dating would suggest, that we need to reconsider all the evidence and into a coherent picture that fits all the evidence, not just take the carbon dating and throw out everything else. And this is stated on it. If people, listeners, search for it, it's on the Oxford Radiocarbon Labs website. Now, these fibers that Raymond Rogers tested, he always said were given to him by a chap called Gonella. And more recently, some people have cast aspersions about the provenance of those samples. Were they really from the shroud? Now, I can reveal to you today that there is some new evidence that has recently come to light. I've heard this from Joe Marino and Barry Schwartz. And this is going to be presented in more detail to the world in a paper that's going to be presented at the upcoming St. Louis Shroud Conference, which is being held in St. Louis in October, which does provide supporting evidence for the chain of evidence, if you like, the provenance of the sample that was given to Raymond Rogers was actually given to him by Gonella and was actually originating from the Turin Shroud itself. So a little while ago, I was talking about the difference between the bloodstains and the image. Now, if you look at the image, you find that it's confined to just the surface fibrils, a very, very superficial depth, far less than that of a human hair. And when you look at the difference in intensity of the image, what you're seeing is not different amounts of colouring of those fibrils, but different numbers of fibrils that have been coloured. And this is at the microscopic level. So it's similar to the pixels, if you like, that make up a black and white newspaper photograph, that the shading in terms of different shades of grey is determined by the number of fibrils that are actually changed and that determines the shade of yellowish discoloration, if you like.
I don't want to get too technical here, but if I'm understanding you correctly, let's say, for example, that if this image was painted on, and there are still those who cling to that notion, you know, we had Dr. Walter McCrone, who's considered sort of the father of microscopy, claiming that he found microscopic particles of paint in the linen. But what you're saying is, if you were to paint that image on there, that paint would soak into the linen, and it would be far deeper into the fabric than the image actually is.
Yes, and the image has been studied by all sorts of techniques, including X-ray techniques that look at the elements that compose the cloth, and there's no evidence of anything extraneous. Actually, the father of microscopy was a good couple of centuries before before McCrone.
But he's considered an expert. He's considered an expert in microscopy.
If you, it's quite interesting and informative to read the dialogue between Walter McCrone and Joe Marino that Joe published in his book, and you can see that actually a lot of what he was, although he was, I have to say, you know, at least he was engaging in discussion. I'll say that for him. He was willing to engage in debate. But when he did, you can see that his arguments, they did, with the best will in the world, they didn't hold any water. That the painting idea doesn't make sense and doesn't fit the evidence. So it's only on the surface fibrils. And of course, back in 1898, when a chap called Secundo Pia was given permission to take photographs of the shroud, the story goes that he nearly dropped his photographic plate in shock when he saw that when he took a negative image of the shroud, that the what appears to be just faint, indistinct stains that roughly conforms to the shape of a human body. In negative, you see a very clear, very well-resolved pattern, which implies that the body image on the shroud is actually like a photographic negative, has the characteristics of a photographic negative. And then there was, and at first when he told people this, they thought he was just, it was a hoax. But it was only when back in the 1930s when the shroud was displayed again, and it was this was tested by other people taking photographs, that it was seen that Pierre was telling the truth. And then in the 1970s, a very pioneering researcher in shroud studies, Dr. John Jackson, who looked at the image of the shroud using an image intensifier, which is designed to look at in more detail, for example, X-ray images and so on, to try and form more of a three-dimensional idea of an image. Now, if you put an ordinary photograph through an image intensifier such as the VP8 that was used, what you see is a random set of peaks and troughs, which don't conform to the shape of the person who the photograph is of. And that's because a photograph is generally formed by reflected light. When you take a photo of someone, they're not shining at your camera, but there's a light somewhere else that's reflected on them. But when you put an image of the shroud in this VP8, you see three-dimensional relief. There's three-dimensional information contained within the image, so that the contours of the face and the body do come out, and you can see them clearly.
Let me just recap there, Dr. Silverman, because this is an important point. What you're saying is, first of all, we'll go back to Secondo Pia, the photographer from the late 19th century, and prior to Secondo Pia's photograph, it was very difficult for people looking at this faint image on the shroud to tell what they were looking at, but he took a photograph of the shroud. And of course, when you develop the film, what you get is a negative image. So one would expect to see a negative image when he developed the film. But what he saw was a positive image, meaning the image on the shroud. I know this is confusing for people listening, but the image on the shroud was a negative image. When you take a picture of a negative, you get a positive. So we're talking about a negative image on the shroud in three dimensions. Again, a pretty tall order for someone, a painter, let's say, in the Middle Ages to produce that.
Yes. And now remember that the actual coloration of the fibrils, you would need, if you were, firstly, there isn't paint on there corresponding to the image, and you would need a paintbrush with just one fiber that was thinner than a human hair, and you'd have to apply it from more than 6 feet away from the cloth, because that's where you can see the image, and it would have had to have been done micro dot by micro dot without leaving any evidence of the paint, but instead causing a chemical change in these surface fibrils that we said it's actually similar to the change that happens to cellulose in paper when it's exposed to sunlight. Now, that brings me on to some other research that was done at the Atomic Energy Research Institute, the ENEA in Frascati, by a team including and led by Dr. Paolo Di Lazzaro. And they did experiments using pulsed ultraviolet lasers. And they found that you could achieve very similar characteristics to the ones that are on the shroud image. By doing that you actually get this oxidation dehydration of the very surface fibrils that are, as I say, about 1/5,000th of a millimeter in thickness. And now, so this is consistent with the notion that perhaps that this dead body somehow momentarily and for a fraction of a microsecond may have shone brighter than.
Sorry, you cut out there, Dr. Silverman. You're saying that for a fraction of a second. You're cutting out there. Let me see if I can get you to back up and repeat that, because we missed it. You're saying that on the shroud, there is evidence that for a fraction of a second, something happened, and then we lost you.
Oh, okay. Sorry. That it would have been fractions of a microsecond, I was saying, that Dr. Di Lazzaro's research is consistent with the notion that there may have been a momentary flash of radiant energy from the body that was once wrapped in the shroud. And I was saying that there are other aspects that do need explaining, such as the directionality of the radiation and so on, but it is consistent with that notion. So the question is, when did this happen? We know it happened after the death of the man because the bloodstains formed after he had died, and we know that forensically. And also, if we were to say, I was alluding to earlier how that the image on the shroud, the body image, doesn't have the same distortions that the bloodstains do. In other words, the cloth was wrapped around, appears to have been wrapped around the face, and then when you stretch it out to look at the cloth, you can see that the bloodstains are superimposed on the hair. But the same isn't true of the face and the body of the man, that you don't see it distorted. Now, also, the other bits of evidence for any listeners...
Okay, let me just jump in here, Dr. Silverman, because we've got the music sort of percolating up here, which is my signal to get out and get into a break here. When we come back, we'll continue to delve into this amazing piece of linen cloth, the Shroud of Turin. Dr. Andrew Silverman, medical doctor, on the line from the UK, coast to coast AM, back in a moment.